Rashi Shimon Gurajas. Oba Acharnar and Bhakti Vedanta Goswami Maharaj Jagaduru Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Jai Vishnu Bhajira Paramahansa Prabhacharya Satara Shishimaj Shila Bhakti Sanat Sarada Goswami Maharaj Pupak Ki Jai Anantra Goti Shri Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai Namachari Shahidas Thakur Ki Jai Praise the Ghost Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhupada Sri Adhari Garara Shivasri Gora Ki Jai Shri Shri Radha and Krishna Gaurvana Sham Kanarakan
For sign of Srimad Bhagavatam, which are very means of conquest, let us offer respect to the blessed. Under the personality of God in the Narayana, of the Narayana, and Rishi, the supermost human being, of the Mother Saraswati, the goddess of learning, and of the Srila Vyasadeva, the author, by regularly hearing the Bhagavatam, and rendering services under the pure devotees, all that has troubled someone in the heart becomes practically destroyed almost anew. Transcendental loving service under the glorious Lord, whose praise of transcendental hymns comes into being established as a new vocal band. So, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 11. The title of the chapter is Swayambhuva Manu addresses Dhruva Maharaj. It's not reading, it's not written. Nityam amritam tatha daivam sarvatmano pei jagat parayanam yasmai balim vishva srijo ranti ghavo yatava nashidham yatrita. Please surrender unto the Supreme Personality of God.
Please surrender unto the Supreme Personality of God.
Who is the ultimate goal of the progress.
Is the ultimate goal of the progress.
Of the whole world. Of the world.
Of the world.
Everyone.
Everyone.
Including the demigods.
Including the demigods.
Headed by Lord Brahma.
Headed by Lord Brahma.
Is working under his control.
Is working under his control.
Just as a bull.
Just as a bull.
Prompted by a rope.
Prompted by a rope.
In its nose.
In its nose.
Is controlled by its owner.
Is controlled by its owner.
The material disease is to declare independence from the supreme control. Factually, our material existence begins when we forget the supreme controller and wish to lord it over material nature. Everyone in this material world is trying his best, to become the supreme controller, individually, nationally, socially, and in many other ways. Dhruva Maharaj fighting with his grandfather, who was concerned that Dhruva was adhering to a personal ambition to fight, to annihilate the whole race of Yakshas. In this verse, therefore, Swayambhuva Manu seeks to eradicate the last tinge of false ambition in Dhruva Maharaj by explaining the position of the supreme control. The words mrityam amritam, death and immortality, are significant. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says, I am ultimate death, who takes away everything from the demons. The demons' business is to continually struggle for existence as lords over material nature. The demons repeatedly meet death after death and create a network of involvement in the material world. The Lord is death for the demons, but for the devotees, he is Amrita, eternal life. Devotees who render continuous service to the Lord have already attained immortality. For whatever they are doing in this life, they will continue to do in the next. They will simply change their material bodies for spiritual bodies, unlike the demons who no longer have to change material bodies. Unlike the demons, they no longer have to change material bodies. The Lord therefore is simultaneously death and immortality. He is death for demons and immortality for devotees. He is the ultimate goal of everyone because He is the cause of all causes. Dhruva Maharaj was advised to surrender unto Him in all respects, without keeping any personal ambition. One may put forward the argument, why are the demigods worshipped? The answer is given here, that demigods are worshipped by less intelligent men. The demigods themselves accept sacrifice for the ultimate satisfaction of the Supreme Personality of God. Tameva mrityam amritam tatadevam sarvatmanopei jagaparayanam yasmaya palim vishvasrijo haranti gavo yatas vayanasi dhama yantrita. My dear boy Dhruva, please surrender unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the ultimate goal of the progress of the world. Everyone, including the demigods, headed by Lord Brahma, is working under His control. Just as a bull, prompted by a rope in his nose, is controlled by its owner. Om Agyanata Marandasya Jana Jana Salakaya Chaksuran Militam Yena Tasmaya Shri Gurave Nama Sri Chaitanya Marombistam Japitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamaya Dadati Sambadantikam Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adaita Gadara Shiva Sri Gaura Bhaktarindam Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So this is a very instructive verse. This is Svayambhuva Manu is instructing Dhruva Maharaj. My dear boy Dhruva, please surrender unto the Supreme Personality of God, who is the ultimate goal of the progress of the world. Everyone, including the demigods headed by Lord Brahma, is working under His control, just as a bull, prompted by a rope in his nose, is controlled by its owner. So, everything in this world has some sort of proprietorship. Proprietorship. What is the meaning of proprietorship? Proprietorship. One who has ownership. Ownership. So we have to evaluate what is ownership. Just like you're attached to your body, but are you the owner of your body? That's the question, isn't it? Do you own your body? That you must define. Whether you own it? Because to own something means that you have full authority over that thing. Just like when you own something, money, you have authority how to spend the money, isn't it? It's your authority. In other words, if you've got 500 pounds, you're the authority how it should be spent. It's not the business of someone else to come and spend it for you, is it? So if someone else tries to spend your money, you will become disturbed, isn't it? Hey, that's my money. No, I decided I'd spend it for you on your behalf. Oh, that's very kind of you. We don't allow people to spend our money because we have some proprietorship on the money, isn't it? We're the proprietor. In other words, we're the owner of that money. We are what we like to call the controller of the money. Just like when you've got lots of money, you become a controller. You decide what you're going to buy. You find this existing in every level of affluence. Some people who are very rich, they spend a lot of money. And they enjoy every minute of the power of money. Money has a tremendous power, isn't it? When you've got some money. And every one of you guys, if you have money, you'd be very important, even in ISKCON. You may not be able to read a book or chant around, but if you had loads of money, millions, every temple you'd go to, you'd get big seats and nice prasadam, isn't it? Now you may say, why don't you get that sort of treatment? Because you don't have any money. Why don't you have lots of friends? Because you don't have any money. When you have loads of money, you have loads of friends. It's so easy to make friends. So easy. You'll find people who are rich, even if they're ugly, They have loads of friends. People ringing them all the time. How are you doing? Because generally we see that when you have money, you have power. When you have anything, you have a certain amount of power, isn't it? Depending on what you have. So we can define qualitatively. The quality of what you have gives you a certain degree of power in this world. The quantity of what you have, we can analyze. We can find that there's a certain amount of proprietorship, ownership of everything. Just like, for instance, we, of course, always explain, we come into this world naked, all of us. Naked generally means at least you've got a bit of skin, isn't it? Not much more. But you come into this world hopefully with a bit of skin. And you have a bit of bones, a few veins and things like that. You bring them with you. But in actuality, you don't have anything from this world. You come out of your mother's womb with something. You come out of your mother's womb with something you collected in her womb, didn't you? You collected a body inside her womb. You didn't have a body before you entered the womb. When you're in the womb, you collect a body. That body is given to you by mother. So when you come into this world, you've already collected something. You collected a body. You didn't have it before. Previously, you were just a little bit microscopic. Little kind of sperm or a little fish floating around inside. But all of a sudden now, you've been given some quantifiable existence. You have more, bigger body than that little tiny body in the womb. Now you have a baby body. And you have accumulated a certain amount of quantifiable substance. Skin, bones, and you have all the other things, mucus, but you have some brain, little brain there. You collected a little brain also while you're in the womb. You picked up a little brain. Now when you come out of the womb, these things are developing. They're developing, isn't it? Your little body, which is so insignificant, becomes more significant by the influence of time, by the interreaction of time, and the 24 elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, all these things, they're all interreacting. So gradually, your consciousness, as it expands, you get more and more domination over matter. In the beginning, your, what do you call it, proprietorship is non-existent. The child is helpless, totally helpless, isn't it? Up until a certain age. Then gradually, as soon as you become more developed, immediately you start owning your toys. You have proprietorship over your toys. You pop anyone who comes to take them. You argue, you fight, you spit. You do anything to stop these other kids getting a hold of your toys. So you can see, as soon as there's a little development of consciousness, immediately there's so many different symptoms. Attachment, greed, lusting after. There's anger, there's frustration. All of these qualities come in. You can see them in children, very obvious, because children are not very good at hiding it, that's all. We're good at hiding it. We put on this sort of sophistication. But in reality, that meanness and greediness and selfish infatuation, self-centered egotism, is very prominent as we grow up. So we find that we become more and more involved in trying to actually proprietorize our existence. We try to be the proprietor. In the beginning, of course, because we have very limited capacity, we have, as a child, some toys, and then as we get bigger, we want bigger toys, more complex toys, and then we notice things more and more around us as we expand our scope of experiencing jurisdiction, we start to see that there's more things we can have. Not only can we have our things, but we can get other people's things as well. So then we get into what is basically called exploitation, different levels of exploitation. Now the thing is that if we study carefully, we have to define proprietorship, because basically are the things that we are trying to own, or the things which we are trying to secure in this world, are they actually our property, or whose property are they? You see, this is the big question of life, because ultimately, everyone is trying to gain something. Now, if you're trying to gain something, that thing which you're trying to gain must have some value, otherwise you wouldn't want to gain it, isn't it? It must have some value to you, right? So that attempt to gain something dependent upon its value. Generally we find that the things that are most valuable are the things which give the maximum amount of sense gratification, the maximum amount of pleasure. You'll find that you study psychology, you'll find that that thing which is the most pleasurable, which gives the most sustainable happiness, is the thing which is sought after the most. So generally we find that individually, and nationally, socially, collectively, there is always competition for proprietorship. We find that, generally speaking, that this material world is very competitive. There is constant competition. Even amongst the different species, there is always different degrees of competitiveness. Individually, there is different degrees of competitiveness. Everyone, every single individual is struggling with other individuals, either individually or collectively, to try to secure maximum. We want to secure the maximum facilities, the maximum amount of pleasure in this world. But the thing is that we have not stopped to understand that what is the proprietorship? What is the proprietorship? We're very, very interested in our own proprietorship. Everyone is very keen to secure their own proprietorship in this world. Isn't it, Ravi? We want to make sure that everything, you'll find everything that you own is very much looked after by yourself. Isn't it? Even if it's only your Brahman underwear. You are very careful to make sure where it is, that no one steals it, that it's there for your pleasure or whatever, and everything you've got, you keep a keen eye on it. Other things are not that interesting to you. It may be that someone else has something. But generally we look over things with the idea if we could get a hold of them, they'd become important. When we can't get hold of them, they're not. Just like there's so many cars on the street, they have no interest to us. The car which is of interest to us is the one outside that's ours, that we can use. Just like Prabhupada said, there are so many women in this world, beautiful women, but the one we're interested in is the one we got. Yes. That's the one we're interested in. There's so much money in this world, but the money we're interested in is the money we've got. There's so many. If you study, you'll find the thing you're vitally interested in is the thing which you have proprietorship over. So this is demonic mentality. This is the very nature of demonic mentality. The whole mentality of the living entity in the material world is to separate. We want to separate the energy from the energetic. This is demonic consciousness. This is material consciousness. We want to separate the energy from the energetic. Therefore, we have so many philosophies, so much different theories, and so many different things. You'll always find that behind all the theories, all the philosophies, all the psychology, all of them, without exception, are based upon exploitation. Exploitation means that the maximum ability to exploit the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's basically all these so-called philosophies and theories, isms, just like Prabhupada used to say, capitalism, communism, altruism. They're all just different actual... all of these different schools of philosophy are basically based on the premise or the understanding that somehow man is the controller of his destiny or his situation or energy itself. So therefore we find that actually in the material world, as Prabhupada used to say, this is the one thing which is a mystic. Just like when you have many, many noughts, you can add up 100 million noughts. It all adds up to naught, isn't it? Suppose you have 500 trillion noughts. What does it add up to? Naught. But as soon as you put one in front, the whole thing takes on a tremendous, inconceivable value. You see? If you have 100 trillion noughts and you put one in front, right, then it becomes extremely significant. So similarly, when we, if you like, ascertain the proprietorship, therefore Krishna says, Bhuktaram Yajna Tapasya. Bhuktaram. Bhuktaram means that I am the supreme proprietor. You see, I am the proprietor. Maya Dakshina Prakriti Suyate Chacharachara. So many verses in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is defining Aham Syavasya Prabhupada, that I am the supreme Prabhupada. I am the master. This is the difference between theism and atheism. Basically, in the theistic school, or in the personalized school at least, there is an understanding that there is a supreme proprietor. There is a supreme proprietor. Now, why should there be a supreme proprietor? We have to look at that. Why should there be a supreme proprietor? Can anyone answer that?
Was something, or obviously someone's created the material world.
Yeah, but why should there be a supreme proprietor?
Because if there's not one center, then everybody's their own center in this clash and conflict. Or if there's one center, then everybody can revolve around that center in a harmonious way.
Yeah, that's philosophically reasonable. But why is there a supreme proprietor? We have to look at that, isn't it? Because we could say, individualistically, we're all proprietors. After all, if life itself was a chemical reaction, we've got just as much chemical right to proprietorship as anyone else. Isn't it? I mean, we're all equally the same. We're all just chemical substance. So, basically, my chemicals and your chemicals are all the same. So, in one sense, it's all one, isn't it? Because we're all chemical combinations. Why should there be a supreme proprietor?
Well, because a proprietor also, apart from owning, he kind of like, he makes sure everything goes okay, you know? So, we don't have the ability to do that so much, but we do a little bit, so someone has to be looking after everything.
So we get down to this point of the energy. The reason anyone has any, if you like, appreciation of anything is on account of its supremacy, isn't it? Why do we see something as better than another? By the qualitative aspect, you understand? By the quality. In other words, we study by natural inclination, we are attracted towards supremacy. You see? Just like you're automatically attracted to someone when they're beautiful. If someone's as ugly as I say, at the back of a bus or something. You just, you know, there's no attraction whatsoever. You can't pretend there is. You can't pretend you fell in love with a 90-year-old hag or whatever you want to call it. Did you? You know, you fall in love with a beautiful 19-year-old, lovely formed and shaped girl whose big eyes twinkle in your face. You fall in love with quality. You see? You fall in love with quality. We are by nature attracted to quality. So therefore, the quality aspect is not understood. Man does not understand quality. They know quality exists, but they don't know why it exists. You see? They don't know why it exists. There's no reason for things to have a quality. You know? Because quantifiably, you could say, just like we say, the very nice example of Lord Chaitanya when he was, eating earth. And he said, but food is just earth. So why shouldn't I just eat earth? It's true. Food is earth. There's absolutely no difference between, you know, the earth and the food. So what is it that is different between the food and the earth is the quality, isn't it? The quality of food, the quality of sense gratification you get from eating food as opposed to eating earth. I mean, if I served you a brick for breakfast, chemically, there's no difference between that and serving you a wonderful six-course meal. But it's the quality. So this quality, when we talk about quality, of course, we get into this area of what we call variegatedness, the variegated quality. You see, the variegated quality, the variety of quality of life, naturally attracts the living entity. We're naturally attracted to quality. You see, we're naturally attracted to quality. And in another sense, we're also made obviously aware of our lack of quality. You see, lack of quality. We all know that we are lacking a few qualities, isn't it? Even if we try our hardest to pretend we're not. There's just certain things in life which make us a little aware that we are lacking a few little qualities. So therefore, the qualitative aspect has to be understood. Now, quality, when we talk about quality, of course, the word English quality, the word quality is not very easy to understand in philosophical terms. So therefore, the Vedic literature say, Atata Brahma Jignasya, Brahma. The word Brahma means great. Basically means unlimited. Not great, but unlimited. The unlimited Brahman. So Atata Brahma Jignasya. Now, in the human form of life, we have chance to study Brahman. What is Brahman? What is the great? You see? What is the great? An animal does not have a chance of studying the great. You see, because an animal does not have developed consciousness to understand quality. Animal does not have the chance to understand what is quality. An animal is simply interested in its immediate, what we call prayas, immediate pleasure. So if something, that's why if you get to the level of a hog, anything that goes in his stomach is fine. If you give a hog a huge bucket of stool, he's just as happy as if you give him a huge bucket. He's more happy than if you give him a huge bucket of hollow. He's completely happy. Each gollop of stool adds increasingly to his pleasure because his stomach expands as it goes in there. He's not worried about the menu, what sort of hors d'oeuvres are there, and a la carte, and whether there'll be beautiful cream pancakes afterwards. He couldn't care a darn. Just whack it in. Whack it in. The only thing probably the hog worries about, if it's a little hot, he likes it. When the stool's hot. That's why when people are passing stool in India, the hog will come and whack. He'll whack you. He just boots you over and then he's in there, whack. And it's just like a Sunday feast. If you've ever seen a devotee at a good Sunday feast, it's the exact experience. I've seen it myself. They wallow in there and they love it. And they're fighting each other over the nice, hot, newly fresh stool. You see? So that is basically why? Because the hog has no discrimination. There's no discrimination. Material life basically means a life of inexperience. It's a life of inexperience. We are feebly trying to have some experience of this energy. And therefore, our hankering after experience becomes manifested in different types of exploitive activity. We want to always increase our experience. That's why you find constantly, more and more constantly, we're reforming, redefining, readjusting everything to make it better and better and better. You see? Now the reason, if we study, why we're always trying to make things better and better and better? Because we have a natural hunger, a natural hankering after the great. You see? We're naturally attracted to the great. The great means the Supreme Personality of God, Brahman. Ishvara Parama Krishna. Ishvara Parama Krishna. Therefore, Krishna is saying, Bhuktaram, I am the supreme proprietor. Therefore, unless you understand Krishna, you cannot understand anything else. Very, very important. You cannot understand anything without understanding God. It's not possible. Because all you're getting through your very limited organic senses is a tiny, fragmental experience of existence. Insignificant beyond comprehension. Your experience of this world is insignificant beyond comprehension. You have practically zero experience of anything. And that's why constantly man is endeavoring more and more to try to subject nature to his scrutinizing senses, to bring it within some definable, controllable, organized scheme of exploitation. Man, the more we bring nature within our subjugation, the more we try to increase our exploitation. That's the whole business of mechanization, industry, commerce, advanced technologies. It's simply to make things more available. You see? More available. More and more gadgets, just like in this room. There's so many gadgets that weren't there before. You see? And we need to increase these gadgets because now they allow us to increase our enjoyable exploitation of nature. So therefore, it actually is very, very important that we understand that nature itself is totally controlled, absolutely controlled, down to every microscopic movement. Every single thing in nature is... That's why the Upanishad, Ishavasham idam sarvam, Yatkincha, everything animate and inanimate that is within these universes is owned and controlled by the Lord. You see, owned and controlled by the Lord. This is very, very important. As it's given here by Svayambhuva Manu, he says that everyone, including the demigods, headed even by Lord Brahma, is working under his control. You see, working under his control. We are totally and utterly working under the control of Krishna. We don't have one single ability to be even the slightly independent of any of Krishna's order. As Prabhupada once said, what we call the laws of nature are actually nothing but the will of the Supreme. The so-called laws of nature are nothing but the will of the Supreme Personality of God. What you're calling as life, or reality, or whatever you want to define it. It is simply the will of Krishna and nothing else. You see? So, this is the meaning of Brahma, the great. The great Brahman, the Supreme Personality of God. Just as the example given here, a bull is a big, powerful creature and has huge muscles and is fierce. But, by this ring in the nose, he's completely control. Now how is he controlled? How is a bull controlled? He's controlled by the actual pain. You see? That bull could easily run away, but he'd rip his nose to shreds. So therefore he has to make a choice. Either I hang on to my nose and stay here, or I do a runner and have my nose wrenched out of its existence by this big ring in the nose. You understand? So basically we find that in the material world, people are controlled by pain. They're controlled by pain, you see? Most of you are here because you've experienced a certain amount of pain, you see? You experience a certain amount of adversity. So adversity itself is very revealing and very important in this world. The material world, many people say, well, if God is so nice, why has he made everything so horrible? But actually, that is his mercy. His mercy is that he's made this material nature very adverse, hostile, extremely hostile. This is a very, very hostile place, the material world. Because, as Bhaktisiddhanta says, there is fire all around and death within. Fire all around and death within. Doesn't sound very good, does it? Doesn't sound like the place you want to go for a holiday. So the material world is fire all around and death within. It is completely hostile to our nature. And that is very kind of Krishna to make it like that. Very kind. That is his supreme kindness. Because in actuality, the living entity wants to forget Krishna, and therefore coming into the material world, he could happily forget Krishna eternally. So-called happily. Happily means that he could go bouncing up and down like a cork in the ocean. Sometimes going up according to his karma, sometimes going down according to his karma. Sometimes becoming a demigod and enjoying in the heavens, and sometimes on expiry of his pious activities, again his poverty is seen. On expiry of our merit, our poverty, just like when your bank account runs out, your checks become useless, isn't it? You find that when you have little pennies in your account, you feel the more the pennies increase, the happier you get. Then when your credits run down, the more anxiety you get. Similarly, the more our pious activities run out, again our poverty is seen. We realize our poverty. So sometimes we find, of course, in this material world, it is full of increment and decrement. Things which are decremental to us make us suffer. Things which are incremental make us happy. But so, therefore, we can understand that material energy is working just like a machine, just like a vast machine. That machine is providing us, according to our actions and reactions, various types of pleasures and displeasures in this world. But Krishna is very, very kind, because he, out of his supreme achintya shakti, inconceivable power, he has been able to build into this material world a wonderful process for taking us all ultimately back to home, back to Godhead. And that is very important to understand, how all of us are, first of all, to get out of a situation, you must understand what situation you're in, isn't it, Ravi? If you want to get out of a situation, you must first of all understand what situation you're in. Otherwise, how can you even begin to get out of it? Huh? You understand my point? You can't get out of something until you understand what it is you're getting out of. It's madness to say you want to get out. Just like people want to solve their miseries, but they don't even know what their miseries are. You see? They don't even know what their miseries are. They think their miseries are because their wife nags them, or because the dog bit them on the way out, or because they didn't get enough wages, or they got the sack, or they didn't have a very good breakfast. But you know, they think all of these things. They're not very intelligent. People are generally not very intelligent. Just like the Prabhupada said, if a stick is beating you, do you blame the stick? Suppose a stick is beating you, right? You're getting beaten. I mean, till blood is coming out of you. And you're shouting at the stick, "Hey, you stick, I've had enough of you. I am so fed up with you, stick. Why are you doing this to me?" But you know that someone's holding the stick, isn't it? Now, it's much more important to negotiate with the guy holding the stick than to negotiate with the stick, isn't it? It's logically intelligent that if you're getting beaten by a stick, you got to start talking with the guy who's got the stick. So what do? Instead of talking to the stick, we talk to the person who's got the stick. So similarly, instead of trying to simply adjust some finite material arrangement, we should understand who's behind the arrangement, who's the arranger. These two things are there, the arrangement and the one who arranged it, isn't it? Just like when I come in this house, there's an arrangement. When I go out in this town, there's an arrangement, isn't it? When I go in someone else's house, there's an arrangement. When I go inside a company, an office, there's an arrangement. We always submit to some higher control. You see? Always, on every circumstances, we acknowledge some arrangement. You know, just like if you decide that you're no longer going to follow the laws of the government, then you will be punished by the arrangement of the government. You say, you can say you're not going to follow the laws. That's entirely freedom for you to do. But you also, in the back of your mind, know that you are going to be subjected to more enforcement. You see, just like there are many laws in Birmingham, and those laws, you don't know, 80% of them, you probably haven't a clue what they are, right? So in generally, they have no interest to you. But you break them, and you'll quickly find out what they are. You understand? Depending on how important they are, as soon as you start breaking them, the law enforcement, they use the word, the law enforcement. In other words, the enforcement of laws is done by the police. So you become acutely aware of law when you start becoming a criminal. Some criminals are expert on law because they've broken so many laws that they actually know what they can get away with or not. So they gradually, whereas the common person who walks down the street hasn't got a clue a lot of times about their rights or not their rights or what they can happen and what doesn't happen. So the point is that when laws are enforced upon you, then you wake up. You see, similarly in the material world, everyone is happy to float along like an animal, eating, sleeping, mating, defending. We're all quite content with that, right? But the problem is that regularly we are being subjected to very heavy dose of material punishment in the form of adidevaka, adiatmika, adipotika, miseries of our mind, miseries of our body, miseries from other people, isn't it? Like the old body. We're always being subjected. So we become more and more, if you like, frustrated by this experience of this subjugation. It actually makes us more and more frustrated. Now there's two ways of dealing with that. The materialist becomes angry and tries to force his will over nature. That's generally how people in this material world, they become angry. They become angry with the inconveniences. Just like a car. A car is a very nice convenience, but it's actually created out of frustration with the inconvenience of walking. Right? The inconvenience of getting from A to B has made us so frustrated that we've created a motor car. Now we can zoom from A to B. So we think that's got rid of the problem. It hasn't. It hasn't. Because in actuality, there are many, 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 many other problems created by this frustration. So in other words, Prabhupada says, for every so-called convenience you get in this world, thousands of inconveniences wait to torture you. That's the nature of this world. For every single thing you do to defy nature, nature has a million other things to smash it. You see? So we're really just like tiny little mice. Just being simply, just like you see that little, what is that, hamster? He runs on the wheel. You see him? He's going like anything, but he's going nowhere. He looks very, guy's giving it everything. I'm going. I'm getting out of here. But really, he's just going around. He's exactly at the same spot as he was when he started. But he feels good. I'm going. I'm leaving. I'm moving. You see? So we're like that. We're moving very, very fast to nowhere. To nowhere. Because ultimately, every one of us are under the stringent laws of the Almighty. And therefore, every one of us, regardless of what we achieved or what we didn't achieve, have to get old, wither away, and vanish. We will be, if you like, destroyed by the very energy that we've been messing around with. So, basically, here, Svayambhuva Manu is pointing out to Dhruva Maharaj that this anger that you have with these yakshas, it is not very sanguine. It is not very good for a devotee. Because a devotee has no business here. We have no transactions. The devotee has no transactions. We're simply here to give pleasure. So therefore, Svayambhuva is pointing out to Dhruva that simply, even the great demigods, they're also struggling. What to speak of you? Just like you may think that you're struggling, but even the great demigods who are controlling the universal affairs, they're also under the complete 100% subjugation of Krishna. So as Prabhupada says in the purport, then why do people worship demigods? They worship demigods because they're less intelligent. So therefore, that's why this Bhagavad is as brilliant as the sun. Because it destroys all the ignorance of the position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You see? Very, very important to study this Bhagavad carefully. To become 100% convinced. One time on a morning walk, Prabhupada stopped and he looked at us and he said, the problem is that you do not believe in Krishna. That is your problem. That is the general problem. People don't believe in God. We don't believe. We try to believe. We'd like to believe. But in actuality, if we really believed in God, then we would totally surrender. There would be no question. We would totally surrender. So our lack of surrender is indicative of our ignorance, of our doubts, of our holding back on Krishna. Therefore, Krishna says, Sarva Dhammam Pratyajaya. You give up all your so-called intelligence, your big, big ideas, your dharma, your so-called piety, your religiosity, your so-called good activities. You surrender unto me. Krishna doesn't hold back anything. Surrender. Surrender means 100% subjugation to the order of the Lord, to the order of God. 100%. No hesitation. So therefore, this is, of course, what Swayambhuva Manu is pointing out to Dhruva, that you should not be so angry over this killing of your brother. So the Kshatriyas have this nature, they become angry. And that's why generally you find Kshatriyas, they have to be always guided by the Brahmins. The Brahmins are there to guide them. When, so here Swayambhuva as Brahmin, he's giving Brahminical, of course he's not Brahmin, but he's giving Brahminical advice that you don't become so disturbed with this situation. You are killing many innocent people out of the anger. Clearing up the situation for Drew. Okay, is there any questions?
You were asking that question, why is it necessary a supreme proprietor, and then you were elaborating on the concept of quality. Could you just explain how that necessarily leads to...
Yeah, well, the thing is, you see, when you talk about creation, the fact that creation is complexly supreme. In other words, the whole idea of studying nature is because of its supremacy. We study it because it is such a wonderful thing to study. You see, like science, they're always there to say how complex, how highly defined nature is. And everyone, even Einstein himself, said that the more I look at the fascinating way that nature works, the more one cannot avoid the question of God. Because in actuality, we ourselves are so pathetically incapable of organizing anything. You know, I mean, for instance, by nature, we find that even just to organize our simple lives is such an endeavor. Even to organize systems, social systems, economic systems, even family systems that work. Anything that we do is... Everything we do has some organizational capacity involved. We have to organize. Every single part of our life is... It's required to organize, to arrange, to make an arrangement. So, the... attraction, like Prabhupada says, the real intelligent way of understanding God is because, firstly, we have to understand that nature works. You understand that? Nature works. If nature works, in other words, people say nature. But what is nature? It is an energy that works. It works in certain ways, just like we call the digestive system, the solar system, the ecological system, this system, that system. We're always studying systems. Now, systems mean something which is systematic, something which is organized. You can't study a system unless it's organized. It's not possible. You can't study something that's chaos. So that's the whole thing, is the more you see, and even scientists now, when they're seeing the complexity of the cell, even a single cell is so complex, it's like a universe. And when they're seeing that, they're actually themselves concluding there is no way this can be accidental. There is no way that it could be just a combination of random features or chemicals or whatever. So the point is that the more one understands the supremacy of nature, in other words, the more we understand how nature works in a cosmic sense, not just in a very small, defined way that we define. Because mostly the reason people don't have faith in God is because they don't understand God. They don't understand how God works, and they don't understand God's energy. So therefore, we find that our observations of nature are so limited that in actuality, on account of that, of course, the defectiveness of the senses, the limited experience, tendency to commit mistakes, tendency to be illusion, to cheat, whatever. Therefore, it's practically impossible, as it says here, that it's impossible. The absolute truth, transcendence, is never subject to the understanding of imperfect sensory endeavor, nor is he subject to direct experience. He is the master of the varieties of energies, like the full material energy, and no one can understand his plan or actions. Therefore, it should be concluded that although he is the original cause of all causes, no one can know him by mental speculation. That is the point, that if we're truly honest, then we can be very clear with the fact that we have extremely limited ability to understand anything, but to speak of God. You know, we have practically no understanding. So therefore, we naturally, by increasing our understanding of things, we naturally assume that we become superior. If you look at this, just study this psychology, right? The more you understand, the more superior you become. But the point is, why are you becoming superior? Because the energy you're understanding is superior. You understand my point? Huh? Okay, let's put it this way. I've got £1,000,000. You've got nothing. The more you get my £1,000,000, the more superior you become. Isn't it? Now, if I didn't have £1,000,000, no matter how much of my money you had, you wouldn't become any superior. Would you? So scientists become superior by understanding science. But then again, science must be superior, otherwise how are they becoming superior? By understanding it. So you get to the point that nature itself has to be superior than you. Otherwise, how do you become superior? By understanding it. Isn't it? It's logical. You become superior. In other words, for instance, the more control you have of nature, the more superior you're becoming. That means that nature itself, is very powerful, because by you controlling it, you're becoming powerful. So if you study it in that sense, that the more you understand how powerful nature really is, and how powerful and intricate its energies are, then obviously, it's only obvious then that whoever created it must be greater than it. So therefore, you have to then come to the conclusion that the cause behind nature is supreme or superior. And if the cause behind nature is supreme and superior, then naturally one has to have knowledge of that. And you can try to have it by mental speculation, but you will not have even a tiny understanding, because you don't have the ability. We don't have the ability to understand one single cell. So how is it that we could have the ability to understand one universe? We'll never understand this universe. There is no human being who will come into this universe and understand it. No. We have no clue. We have a tiny little amount of experience. Life is a life full of inexperience. So therefore, that is why it is very important that one hears from the absolute plane. Because only hearing from the absolute plane can actually solve this problem of inexperience. That's why hearing is so important. Speculation is not very important. Speculation is not very important. It may be you can say, oh, okay, then I have to hear, I have to become blind. No, no question of blind. Because if what you're hearing is intelligent, if what you're hearing is practical and realistic, then naturally you can surrender to that. But it requires a little intelligence of hearing. In other words, if I give you a load of advice about quantum mechanics, and I don't have a clue about quantum mechanics, happens, then you'll obviously very quickly begin to realize this guy hasn't a clue what he's talking about, isn't it? But if I'm able to define things very expertly in a very scientific way, then you'll naturally want to study further, at least what is the actual depth of my knowledge. Similarly, like Prabhupada used to say, it is not a question of religion or a question of faith. It is a question of reality. The soul is passing from baby to boy to youth to old age. And similarly, the soul passes into another body at death. Now, if you can clearly understand that the soul does pass, consciousness passes from baby to little boy, to little teenager, to middle age, gradually to old age, then what is the difficulty to understand that this knowledge that's telling you about the transmigration of the soul would also be able to tell you that at death it passes into another body? So that is the point of Vedic philosophy. It's not sentimental. It's not something that has to be accepted blindly or on some sort of faith. It is the actual study of the absolute truth in scientific terms. And it may not all fit in within our little cranium, our little brains, but that does not in any way discredit anything, because there is probably a million or millions of subjects that your little brain, if it went along to, would take a long time to start even understanding. Right? It's a fact of life. You don't just walk into a university and know all about mathematics or know all about this or anything. You have to take some faith in that teacher and the learning process to acquire anything in this world. So therefore, one has to, in the beginning at least, have some submissiveness that this knowledge is coming from higher authority. And to go even further, the authenticity of something would be based upon how deep it can go into describing the supremacy of the absolute truth. You know, how deep can it go into it? In other words, let's take away all this religious sentiment and just get down to the point that philosophy can only be as deep, or can only be validated, verified in how deeply it exposes the absolute truth. You know, in other words, if your philosophy cannot explain everything knowable within the human brain about the absolute truth, then it's not absolute philosophy. So philosophy really should be able to take you to every level possible within human experience of understanding the absolute truth. And that's what the Vedas do. So therefore, put it to the test. Put it to the test. And see how supreme this philosophy really is. Okay, Srimad Bhagavatam Pran.
What did Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj mean when he said that death is within?
Fire all around and death within. Material world.
What does it mean, death within?
Well,
within
the material world, all there is death. Yeah, well, there's death in you too, isn't there? You're dying at every second. Every moment you're dying. There's things on you dying every moment. You didn't know that, did you? Didn't feel like they're dying, did it? But they are. You're always dying. You're dying, the cells in your body are dying, the little bugs in your body are dying, the germs are dying, everything's dying and then rejuvenating again into different bodies. So within your little universe, your body, there are billions and trillions of things dying at every moment. Even that point, but that wasn't the point being made, but that is another point, that you are the abode of death. Did you know that? You're the planet of death. Mritya Loka. Srimad Bhagavatam Mahapuranam Ki Jai Shri Prabhupada. There might even be all great sages with long beards sitting on your intestines looking at the sky saying, Om. Who knows what you got living in you? A lot of great yogis and everything. Then again, there could be just a bunch of bewildered germs. But at least they do get... they may not be able to get hold of your prasadam when it goes in. I don't know how expert they are at catching pieces of curd sabji as they come down. But they'll get pleasure, they'll get benefit from the holy name. So you can chant to them at night. Thank you, sir. You can get a little... They go around with a tannoy.
Hi, Bo!
I was thinking, you know the way you always people who don't know, they always hope that at least someone, knows what's going on, you're going to come back or whatever. Whatever, someone should know what's going on. So in that sense, for someone who's like saying that doesn't have this knowledge, like you said, it's like kind of like a planet, like your body. So for those people, the main guy, he doesn't even know anything either. So imagine if you find out, like, in the universe, even the top guy, we'd be thinking, he must know what's happening, but he's just as bewildered as us, that'd be pretty bad.
Well, in one sense, even the great demigods are bewildered, so.
Yeah. Well, at least Lord Brahma, he has some idea.
Well, Lord Brahma, yeah. Imagine even he's amazed at Krishna's energy. It's no end to the amazement, because there's no limit to the energy of Krishna. There's no, if you like, borders, or no definable borders of understanding God's energy. God's energy is all unlimited. So even his material energy is unlimited. It doesn't mean
it's not like you get there and then you've got there.
Never. You can never understand it.
That means unless someone is fully taking charge of Krishna, then he could be brought at any time by the amazing energy.
Yes. So what's the story today? It's getting near Christmas. Monday, isn't it? We got Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Saturday. Sunday's Christmas Eve.
The last week. You're doing really big, eh?
I'm doing okay. I think I'm doing okay.
I heard somewhere. Were you chanting his glories?
Dave.
Huh?
Dave.
300. Where is Dave?
Cambridge.
He's like a wandering mendicant. I never see him. Wherever I come, he's... Last time he was down in Brighton. Now he's in Cambridge. By himself.
Steve might be going there. Maybe actually meets there. Maybe.
How's Steve doing?
Pretty good, all in all. So, a little bit, hasn't been out every day or anything, but when he goes out, he's trying hard. He's determined to try and do good.
How long are you up for?
Until Wednesday.
You going out in London?
I'm going out in London. Came to Oxford Street.
You kind of settled down there now.
Well, I'm settled.
Good atmosphere. Then.
It's good. It's nice. It's nice. We're still doing after about a little work with you later, if that's possible.
Sounds very ominous.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah.
It was little words. No, little words. I have to add. Keep me going. I think, let's get it, because I gotta keep going. Yeah, there's cushions, right?
Yeah.
You want to get up?
Stay there, we'll bring it.
Yeah. Well, I can always wait, so don't hold you up.
Well, no, it's fine, no problem.
we don't get it now.
Yeah, you might be looking for me for a couple of years. That little word might become a whole book.
You had to get the
little cars out there, Thomas. It's a good car, boys.
It's a good
one. Yeah. Try and look after it, though. You know, get it serviced and make sure keep oil and water checked.
Yeah.
I don't know if it burns oil. I haven't checked it, but it was.
How regularly did you check it?
So. Well, I've only used it once. I only just came up here.
It's different for every car.
Well, the thing is, what you do is you just. I think what it is that you work out how many miles according to your miles, you know, at least every 100 miles you just check the oil, make sure it's all right. And then what you do, I would say any vehicle that's given to you needs a service. That one is running fine, but the only thing I noticed was sometimes when you're coming up to an island, it conks out only once or twice. And that could be just because it needs tuning.
No harm in giving a good chance. I know a guy where he said 70 quid for a totally full service.
Yeah.
It's pretty cheap.
You got to make sure they do what they're going to do. But the power of the car itself has power. I can go 89 miles an hour. The point is that you just, you know, look up and make sure the water's all right. And make sure, I put a bit of antifreeze in, but if it gets really cold, might be an idea when you're topping up, top up an antifreeze rather than just water.
Mm. This guy was a nice guy. He did that with somebody. He's a sea guy. He changed everything, all the gearbox, the oils, the whole thing, air filters.
It probably needs an oil change, definitely.
Oil.
But one thing is, sometimes when the car is running good and then you take it and get it done,
it gets worse.
It's even worse.
That's true.
So sometimes, you know, what I do, if it's working all right, I just generally change the oil, the filter. Sometimes I found they're just the timing and stuff. Each car is very temperamental and individualistic. Sometimes they just work because they work. I always have the philosophy, things work even when you start having little problems, you get it done. But at least you change your oil, because the oil is like when you get time, just take it into the garage, just change the oil, the filter.
Yeah.
And the air filter. Oil filter, air filter. But it's a good little car.
Was it about every 3,000 or 6,000 miles? Which isn't it? Wasn't it
well, 4,000 max.
Yeah.
Diesels are 3,000. Petrol.
So you put a little small sticker in the corner
what
mileage it is, and then change it again the next after 3,000.
That car's got plenty of power.
Service.
The other thing is, you need an extra tire. It's not a spare tire. Just make sure the air is tight. I mean, you should have no problem. I mean, it was zipping around. You might need at a certain point adjustment on the clutch. You know, I mean, it's moving into gear fine, but I just felt that sometimes if it gets tighter to go into gear, so you just have the clutch checked. It's always just adjustment.
What do we hear about oil?
Nah, generally not, but you can check that also when you bring it in for an oil change. Just ask to check the gearbox. But no, there's no problem with the gear change. It's as good as my car. It's fine.
With services, they're not mandatory, is it? When you get a service for it, do you change?
Well, generally, you see, service should be a good tune-up. Tune-up means things run better.
They generally do it all in one go, because I said to them, he just put in a new air filter in mine anyway for something else. So I said, I already have an air filter, don't they? He said, it just comes in a pack. They buy like a whole service thing, they just change everything. So they just, you know.
Anyway, right now, that thing will see you through Christmas, no problem.
Yeah, I worry about it after Christmas.
I wouldn't worry about it right now, just keep going. But just check it on
the morning. It's Monday,
Monday.
It's
Monday today.
You're not sure if it's Monday.
Yeah.
Now, the only thing is that he gave me a little tiny little piece of green paper at the bottom, and I should have that. But
he's meant to put it in his name if you can.
No, he should. Yeah. What you can do is you just go to the post office, the application for documents, logbook. Fill that up. Huh?
Alright.
Because you see the logbook, when it comes back, it's going to come in my name.
Alright.
So you
would have to do the same thing. You take it into the post office and change of ownership. So you might as well do it now. Just go to any post office, get a form, which is, you know, just say the logbook's lost.
Right.
And then what they'll do is when you apply, they'll probably, they'll put you on, because the logbook's not proof of ownership, and then they'll write to me and say, this guy has applied for his name in the logbook. And if I don't answer, they just let it go.
Okay.
If I don't complain.
Yeah.
They always write to the last person who's the owner. Because, see, I could have bought that and sold it the next day. So you're applying for a logbook. Nothing wrong with it at all.
Mm-hmm. Why isn't he just right there? I just bought from Tanzania.
Well, you don't need to prove anything. See, logbook doesn't prove ownership. Mm-hmm. So if you write for a logbook, they'll just write to the person, the last person on the logbook, and say, this guy wants to be on the logbook.
But isn't it better if he says that he bought it from you rather than he said it was lost, and at the same time you've just applied for it? No, it looks a bit dodgy. I mean, he's saying...
No, you weren't given a logbook when you got the car. That's all you're telling him. When you get that form, he'll say, did you receive a logbook? You say, no.
Yeah.
You sign it and send it off. And once you've signed that and said that, you're criminally implicated if you're telling lies. You see what I mean? Because you've sent the paper with your signature.
Yeah.
Saying, no, I got this car and I didn't get a logbook.
Yeah.
So if they want to, they could prosecute you for saying that it's your car. If it wasn't. Because you didn't get the car. You stole it or whatever.
Yeah.
So they're not worried about the fact that you don't have to give this, oh, I received that, paid this much and all that. They don't care. It's not their problem. It's the police problem. If you stole that car and then applied for a logbook, then they'd write to me and say, hey, do you know this guy applied for a logbook? And I'd say, hey, that guy stole the car.
Mm-hmm. You know?
But it's not DVLC's problem. You understand? They just want to be tuned in to the news on the logbook.
Yeah.
Is it the right guy or the wrong guy? But the criminal side of it is the police. You don't have to prove ownership of DVLC. It's not their problem. See what I mean?
Yeah.
That's why they say strictly on the logbook, does not prove ownership. That's your problem to find. So if you ever get a car and they give you a logbook, it doesn't mean that the guy who gave you a logbook is the owner, but you assume it is, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
You just assume. But a lot of times people are wrong. They lose the whole car, even if they spend 20 grand. They lose the car.
Maybe.
Yeah. The car belongs to the owner.
How does the owner, how do you know who's the owner?
The guy who bought it has a receipt. That's the only thing that proves ownership, is the receipt of ownership.
Hey,
not logbooks.
You know that, like, I ran up and I said, there's that guy, the 150 quid he was trying to sell us a car, came on the next morning, and he's trying to just give it to us. Yeah, and he's filled out all these, he's written, I give this car to, and then the space for our name, and Colin Dallow on it. So I signed, you know, and then he'd done all these receipts to himself, and he was really fried, he wouldn't take it, wasn't he?
Oh, you wouldn't even take it as a gift?
No.
What went on with it? No tax from the team?
No, someone said that they saw him trying to get it going, it wouldn't even start at the desk.
Which kind of
thing? See, the thing is... Course.
Maybe it's still out there.
Huh?
You just
don't
take it.
You said you'd know that before, so...
Yeah.
The other thing is, if you've got a scrapper's car, it costs you £25.
He's
in
his own next door.
Yeah. He's probably just trying to get it off his own.
That's the problem. So, I mean, who is it? Shimon Pine getting a car. It cost me 25 quid
to scrap.
Yeah. I said, you say 25 quid, give me that ethic, John. Careful. Yeah. Oh, we eat next door, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's for breakfast?
Boys and milk.
because you're going to drip all right by the time you get there.
Okay, well, that's a bit more
right. Yeah, joke.
Yeah, have you been?
What's that?
You can't escape the fact, man.
What is it?
That's the main fact.
It is amazing how hard one person is the cause of everything, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's why most people there. Can't comprehend it. Really? Like if you said, okay, suppose you say it's not one person, suppose you say it's a million people, does that make it any better?
No, it all boils down to, it seems that
it's cause and effect.
It's kind of just like, why him, you know? That's what it really comes down to for people, I think. You know, like envy, you know? Like, I mean, okay, it could be one person, but I mean, you know, like, what do you mean?
That dollar's coming.
Yeah.
Why do I have to be Krishna, you know? The idea of person is, you know, first of all, it has a almost like a dirty negative thing to it, isn't it? Yeah. You know, a person, you know, like, you mean like
just a normal person, isn't it?
Like George the postman, you know?
Yeah.
So the idea of person is not even understood. We don't understand what it means, person. Anthropomorphize in the sense that we project the idea of personality as belonging to some demigod or creature or something like that. But the personality itself cannot be understood unless it's understood spiritually.
Yeah.
You know, but spiritually, because personality comes from the soul, not from the material world.
Doesn't everything come from personality in one sense?
Everything. Yeah. Everything. Every single thing.
Yeah. Everything has to come from personality.
Yeah.
That's the thing, yeah, people get confused when you talk about personality, person, you know, they don't really know what you're talking about. Even in terms of being human.
See, the other thing is that they say, well, okay, if God is there, where did he come from? And then you say, he came from God. Where did that God come from? He came from God.
Mm.
The point is, there's no where did he come from, because there's no creation. So all you have, the only choice you've got, you either accept God or you don't.
Yeah.
See? So there's no question of God being created, and then he created the heavens, and then he created the earth, and then he created the universe. It's still so rubbish. God is the unlimited,
absolute,
supreme, absolute truth. And if you want to study the absolute truth, that's religion, philosophy. But he doesn't create or be created by anything.
It goes back to that point you were making there about qualities, that Bhagavan is the person who's got all beauty, all knowledge, all things like that. But then, like, why is it... You were saying that there necessarily has to be a supreme provider, right? So in the same way you could ask the question, well, why does there necessarily have to be one all-powerful person, or one all-beautiful person, or one all-knowledgeable person? I mean, why is it necessarily that one person has all these attributes in full and complete? Whereas...
We still come back to the thing. Which was first, the chicken and the egg, isn't it? That's the whole $64,000 question of philosophy. If you say that God is a person, and God is not a person, That's our particular interpretation of the absolute truth. You can say God is energy or is not energy. You can say God exists or doesn't exist. The point is that the absolute truth is the absolute truth. And you have to decide how you want to approach the study of the absolute truth. So what we're saying is the absolute truth can only be studied from the absolute truth. God can only be known from God. There's no one can write anything about God, because nobody knows about God. But if God wants to tell you about God, then you can know God. So that's why the whole thing of Vyasadeva being the incarnation of God, or the absolute manifestation of God, because he
understood that. Vyasadeva, the literary incarnation of God, I don't get that wrong. I mean, you know, he's a great sage, and you know, he wrote, you know, but I mean, how is he the literary incarnation of God?
He has the power to ease, what do you call it, subdivation, the power to write about God now. It's the same principle. Hey, I'm a policeman, right? Now that policeman is empowered by the government to be a policeman.
Right.
Now that guy may dress as a policeman,
right,
but he hasn't been empowered by the government to be a policeman. Therefore, he's arrested, and he's not, because he's bogus.
Right.
So this is a question of empowerment. Krishna sometimes empowers the living entity, or he sometimes himself empowers himself. When I say empowers himself, I mean in the sense that he displays
certain
his potencies,
yeah,
in a certain way. So all of these, even we individually are a manifestation of God's energy.
Yeah.
So in one sense, we're a manifestation of God,
yeah,
but in a different variety. So this whole thing of variety is there.
Mm-hmm.
And Krishna is... So that's why sometimes we glorify the ass as God.
Yeah.
In another sense, we say he's the living entity. You see, it's contradictory, but it's not.
Mm.
That's why we say, Chinti Beda, Beda Tapa. The ass is adored even by great sages and demigods, because he's being given
special service.
Yeah. He's empowered to do a job. And therefore, he's worshipable as God. That's why the guru is the representative of the ass. He's also worshipable as God.
Yeah. No, it's a. I understand. It's kind of a.
I think our difficulty is because we think in terms of creation. You know?
Yeah, we're always thinking that. Give me one more point.
It's interesting. So the other day, someone was saying to me that, another way the material world may have like a negative connotation of, I was saying that God has to be so, you know, very beautiful. So. Not that people think in terms of that's a negative thing, because we always talk beauty is only skin deep, and people are so attracted to beauty, and it's such a shallow thing. And actually, if it's deeper than that, you should be able to, you know, love ugly people just as much and all the time. So why should God be beautiful and all? And I was just sort of trying to explain that point, that we see it as a negative thing in our experience of it, but it doesn't mean that ultimately that it is. They kind of find it hard. You can understand how they find it hard to think that why does something like beauty, which seems shallow here,
yeah,
have to be something so good that God should have to have it? You know what I mean? And once it's almost like, how is he limited that he even he would have to be, you know, need to be beautiful to be special or whatever?
Yeah, but you have to get back to the quality of consciousness or life. The inherent qualities of life are beauty, knowledge, happiness, love, you know, all of these qualities that we hold dear to us are actually because they exist within us.
Uh-huh. But why would beauty be specific?
Well, because beauty itself is completeness, isn't it? Everything, you know, when we talk about the absolute truth, it means the absolute complete.
Yeah.
And in order to be complete, you have to have unlimited qualities.
There's no separation.
You can't separate the quality from completeness. You can't say that I'm a complete person, but I'm not very beautiful. But I'm still very complete. That's what we do in the material world. We try to skip around the actual inadequacies of life by saying, well, you know, I may not be very good looking, but I'm a really nice guy. Or I may not be very good at making money, but I'm very sweet. You know. Because in actuality, what we're doing is we're trying to substantiate our completeness by, basically cheating.
Sure.
Just cheating.
So wouldn't it be then equally so, to be fully complete, surely not only beauty would have to be there, but everything. Like, you have to be an expert piano player, expert this, that. Everything, you have to be able to do it perfectly to be fully complete, right?
You might get away with not being able to play the piano.
No, but do you know what I mean? For example.
Maybe not.
No, why not? How can it be complete?
Yeah,
if you take it like that,
you have to
be a source of all great things.
You know what I mean? Because we're only talking about beauty and you make that point.
Yeah.
But
then again, Krishna does play the piano.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, sure he does.
Well, he does everything, because it says in the Bible, everywhere are his hands and legs, and this way the absolute truth exists.
Mm.
So he is doing it.
He's doing it, yeah.
Well, one thing is, can you say that if God is complete because he's beautiful, then wouldn't you have to say that...
Well, it's only one of the things.
Wouldn't you say that God would have to be the absolute ugly person as well?
If you really get into it, Advaita, the one indifference, then it's true that everything positive and negative exists in God. But how he associates with those energies are by his mystical power. In other words, Krishna is killing. But Krishna doesn't do any killing because he's always enjoying in Vrindavan. But through his energy, he kills the whole universe. So therefore,
So it would be like another
Krishna.
From one point of view,
the ghastly form.
Yeah, he can. All positive and negative energies within this universe are owned and controlled by the Supreme Absolute Truth. So in one sense, they're manifestations of him in varied forms.
How do we decide? Like, say,
you are as well. You're also. You're also a manifestation of Krishna, but in a separated form. And that manifestation is according to your quantitative and qualitative association with matter. So therefore, matter itself holds. In other words, this milk comes out of the grass, right? So in one sense you could say the milk's in grass, right? But there's no milk in grass. So this is the meaning of the Chincha Shakti. Chincha Shakti means that Krishna can do everything. So he says, although everything is resting in me, I am not in it. Behold my mystic omnis. So in other words, Krishna is in everything and doing everything, but at the same time he does nothing. Supreme Lord walks, he doesn't walk. He's everywhere, he's very far away. He's very near as well. He's inside, he's outside, he's upstairs, da, 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 you know. He's a complete contradiction.
You go into upstairs, the
so if you get into trying to analyze God, you have to get into this completely contradictory. See, everything possible and impossible must be completely resting in God. In other words, everything.
Our minds don't accommodate the impossible.
We only go by allowing our possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say God is the ugliest thing in the universe, he is.
Yeah, I'm saying
not in his form. Not in his form.
Exactly. You have to understand how he's manifested. So just like death, Krishna says, I am death. But nobody wants to see God as death. But he is death.
Like,
you know, when a little baby gets his head chopped off, you know, the last thing you're thinking of, that's God doing that. But it is God doing it. Of course it is. So that's where people have a lot of difficulty accepting the nature of God.
Well,
they can accept God when he's, you know, a little lamb and he's kissing the lamb. Well, that's God. But not when he's smashing little babies with pops underneath 10-ton lorries.
Then if God's nature is such a dananda, then and everything is no different from God, then how can there, you can't find any enjoyment in that, right? There's no enjoyment in that.
Yeah, so therefore Krishna
some people find enjoyment.
By separated energies.
No, some people do.
That is a perverse. There is enjoyment there. But Krishna says, my separated energy. I mean, it's just like, your hair is you, but if I find 10 of your hairs in my meal, I'm not very happy about it. But you could say, hey, that's me and your food. You know, what are you moaning about?
Nice hair. Especially
if you like me, you should like my hair. That could be an argument, but the point is it's your separated energy. You know? So you're in the food, but you're not in the food at the same time. So, in one sense, that's a little sort of crude example of how to understand.
Isn't this one? You know, there was this thing about Sai Baba. And he, a lot of his previous followers, you know, are coming out and saying that he's been molesting, like, young boys for years and years. And
I always knew he was a pervert.
But guess what? And they were saying that, you know, and the way we kind of like understood it was, you know, for a long time was like it's a special mercy and this and that and all this, and you know, because God, He's God, and you know, all good things, all bad things are in God, you know. So what, you know? It's okay. You know, how they philosophize.
Jesus. Rather than
just
only give a little time,
but
when I was mystified,
a little holiday,
yeah.
When I was mystified,
is it feast day today?